Let me wind up the thing till it pile up. Big bumper girl, just a wine and a while up. They must spoil me a stock till it pile up. My money no, so it my
you
money
dance no. Like you mean it. Dance like you on fire and you want me to know. You move like you mean it, shawty. See the look on your face. You either wanna fight or wanna make love, maybe both. They got me looking at you, looking at you, watching the way you wind it and pop it. One more time, girl, wind and pop it, yeah, yeah. Bumper that drink got me feeling alright. Pretty little thing, I could watch it all night. Pull up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Pull up on that bumper, girl, I just might. Baby, push back when I jump behind it. When I jump behind it. So when I jump behind it, push back on me. So baby, push back when I jump behind it. Baby, let me know you like it. Tonight, let's give them something to see. Everybody's singing.
Chasing my booty amazing. Come on, baby, chase it. Back to the floor, give us space.
And looking at me, watching the way I wanted him popping. One more time, I wanted him popping. Yeah, baby, that drink got me feeling alright. Pretty little thing, you could watch me all night. Pull up on his bomba, boy, I don't mind. Pull up on his bomba, boy, I don't mind.
Baby, push back when I jump behind it. When I jump behind it. So when I jump behind it.
Put it on you one time, my phone no stop ring. Hello? Man, I ring off my cellular. No chat, but tell me what you tell her. Jump up, me the body drum till the cocky broke. My girl, you know, see no when you cocky top, rough it up on the dresser top. We no need bed, me a done. Every month, I fi do what me say. Hello?
I want it. Love when you wind up on it. Big, big bumper, you don't stall it. All if I end the money.
Baby, push back when I jump behind it. When I jump behind it. When I jump behind it, push back on me. So baby, push back when I jump behind it. Baby, let me know you like it. Tonight, let's give them something to see. Everybody's in here.
I hope we got the right mic. There it is. I just was speaking into the wrong mic. It's kind of confusing, but I got the right mic, I think. Okay, so welcome. It's a beautiful day, and our days are getting shorter. Well, pretty soon it'll be the autumnal equinox where there's equal hours of sun and dark, and then it'll start getting darker and darker, and then it'll be the first day of winter. I guess that's when our shortest day of the year. So we are enjoying a beautiful summer, and I just want to update you on some things I'm doing. I am studying to be a NASA ambassador for the OSIRIS-REx mission that is in Bennu right now. It's at asteroid Bennu, and there was certainly certain reasons they chose Bennu. They narrowed it down from thousands of asteroids, and now they're at Bennu, and they're circling around. They have chosen four sites as potential sites for extracting the regolith from the surface of Bennu. So I will keep you updated on that, and I'm going to take a test soon on that at the NASA web, or not NASA, at the OSIRIS-REx website. I've been studying for the test. And if I pass the test, I will be, I don't know, certified NASA ambassador or just a NASA ambassador, but it'll be fun anyway. So I'm studying up on that. And in case anybody doesn't know, I don't know how many years ago, the spacecraft flew out to Bennu. And I'm not sure. Just wait. I got my wires crossed now. I'm sorry. I'm not sure if that's the spacecraft. No, I think the New Horizons spacecraft went to Pluto. And I think the New Horizons is on a way to another, I guess it's called a dwarf planet, MU2619 or something like that. I believe it's MU2 something. So it's, and that has done some interesting things. And it has occulted stars and other things on the way. And it's kept NASA busy and it kept people like me entranced because that's interesting stuff. So right now, the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft has been, I think, orbiting Bennu since last Christmas or New Year, something like that. So it's been there about 8 months, taking, or 7 months, doing tests, orbiting. And I'm not sure if this is the spacecraft, but either New Horizons or this OSIRIS-REx, it hibernated for a few years on its way out to their missions. So I don't know if aircraft or spacecraft have done that before. And not long, I think it might have been up to 5 years. So right now, NASA has selected 4 final candidate sites for the asteroid sample return mission. So I'm thinking, why not read about that now? So again, OSIRIS-REx, it's OSIRIS, all capital letters, dash R, or capital R, capital EX, and I think it's RE stands for Regolith, and EX stands for Explorer. So it's OSIRIS-REx Regolith Explorer. So they've selected 4 sites, and I'm going to read about that now. That's on www.nasa.gov. It's dated August 12th. So it says NASA mission selects final 4 site candidates for asteroid sample return mission. And one thing that I'm really intrigued about is the OSIRIS-REx headquarters, I believe, is in the University of Arizona. I think it's maybe at Tempe, I'm not sure. But they are looking for volunteers to do certain things. And if I wasn't working or if I didn't need the money, I'd be down there like a shot, bang, volunteering, because it would be a lot of fun to be involved with NASA and stuff. So they keep sending all their OSIRIS-REx people, like potential ambassadors like me and other people that are interested in the project. So maybe I'll read one of those later. But right now, we're just going to look at the 4 sample sites. So what's going to happen is, I believe, could be around December, the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft will move towards asteroid Bennu. And then it'll come within maybe a few centimeters or tens of centimeters away from the asteroid. Then it will extend its arm. And then the arm, I believe, will touch the surface of Bennu. Then nitrogen gas will be blown out, and they hope the regolith will be stirred up, float up in the air, and then float into the container. So they want to capture a certain amount. It could be 60 grams, something like that. Then they're going to go back up in orbit and test the sample, if it's enough, if it's adequate. If it's not, I believe they're going to go down again and touch the surface and do that again. It could be one time, one additional time, it could be 2, but let's say it's one additional time. And then when they're satisfied, I suppose there's testing things on the spacecraft. When the sample, the regolith, so the regolith is the loose soil on the surface of the asteroid. I guess regolith is, also you can call the moon's surface layer regolith. So it's the topsoil, I guess. When they're satisfied they have enough regolith, the spacecraft will return towards Earth. And it could take something like, I don't know, a few years, up to 5 years. I'm not sure. I don't want to quote a time because I'm not sure. Then the spacecraft will drop the soil sample. And it will drop towards Earth, and it will go through the atmosphere, and then it'll be picked up on the Earth, and it'll be studied, the surface of the asteroid and the regolith of the asteroid Bennu. So what's intriguing is, I guess we can call it primordial matter. It's regolith, dirt, or matter, or subsurface, or surface soil, or just topsoil that has probably been around since the beginning of the solar system. So it's pristine, it's quite old, and scientists can try to learn a lot about what the solar system was like back then, and they can test it against their theories and their models. And I do believe there's going to be a certain amount of samples saved for future generations, just like the Apollo missions they are now, I believe, are testing samples from the 50 years ago from the Apollo mission. What was interesting also, there was something on the news, I believe last night, where some of the topsoil on the Earth, it could have been in the Arctic, but somewhere, was tested against a sample that was taken about 100 years ago. And boy, they said things have changed in terms of the topsoil and what it means for, somehow they linked it to global warming. So it's interesting what the scientists are doing with this. So I'm going to read this article. It says, NASA mission selects final four site candidates for asteroid sample return. So again, the OSIRIS-REx is a spacecraft that took off a few years ago, flew to asteroid Bennu. It's been there now for about 7 or 8 months, orbiting, doing tests, and they're narrowed the mission down to four sample sites, where the spacecraft will go to the surface, then extend out its arm, touch the surface, blow some nitrogen gas, hope that enough of the regolith of the surface of the loose topsoil floats up, and then eventually floats down back onto the into the little container, and then excuse me for that, then they will go back up, the spacecraft will orbit, it will test if this sample was adequate, and then if it's not, they'll go down again, take another sample, and then they will return to Earth, drop the capsule that contains the regolith, it will float down to Earth, it will drop to Earth, it will be retrieved, and I believe the OSIRIS spacecraft will then orbit the sun to do further testing. So very interesting stuff. So I'm going to read now, August 12, 2019, NASA mission selects final four site candidates for asteroid sample return. And it's, it says release 19-066. So let me make a quick comment. I mean, this is fascinating stuff, all the science, all the things they have to, all the things they have to plan for, and it seems so interesting. But of course, if me or anyone else went on the mission, we'd be thrilled. And then when we got to the asteroid, it would be amazing. But imagine having to be dropped down and live on an asteroid for a while. I think it'd get pretty boring. Yes, I think it would. So there'd be no MTV and no Gilligan's Island, no Gilligan's Island reruns. So that would be boring, wouldn't it? We couldn't watch our favorite president, Mr. Trump. We wouldn't have TV up there. We couldn't hear anything that he says. Okay, or Trudeau or anybody else. So now I'm going to name the sample sites. One is called Nightingale. One is called Kingfisher. One is called Osprey. And one is called Sandpiper. So it's interesting how they've named them after birds. When I was in India, I took the Kingfisher Airlines, and that is when I found out that a kingfisher is a bird. I didn't know that before. Okay, so these are the four sample sites, and it says, pictured are the four candidate sample collection sites on asteroid Bennu selected by NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission. Site Nightingale, top left, is located in Bennu's northern hemisphere. Sites Kingfisher, top right, and Osprey, bottom left, are located in Bennu's equatorial region, and site Sandpiper, bottom right, is located in Bennu's southern hemisphere. In December, one of these sites will be chosen for the mission's touchdown event. So let's take odds. Let's have a betting thing, a betting line on Vegas. Which site will they go? I'll say Nightingale. Okay, anyway. So I'm going to start to read the article. It says, NASA mission selects final four site candidates for asteroid sample return. And this is dated August 12, 2019, on NASA.gov under the OSIRIS-REx page. Okay. After months grappling with the rugged reality of asteroid Bennu's surface, The team leading NASA's first asteroid sample return mission has selected four potential sites for the origins, spectral, interpretation, resource, identification, security, regolith, explorer, or CyrusRex spacecraft to tag its cosmic dance partner. Since its arrival in December 2018, the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft has mapped the entire asteroid in order to identify the safest and most accessible spots for the spacecraft to collect a sample. These four sites now will be studied in further detail in order to select the final two sites, a primary and backup, in December. So I don't know why they do a backup, but that's what NASA does. It backs everything up. So that would be interesting if for some reason they chose a site and couldn't do it and then they went to the backup. We'll see what happens. The team originally had planned to choose the final two sites by this point in the mission. Initial analysis of Earth-based observations suggested the asteroid surface likely contains large parts of fine-grained material. The spacecraft's earliest images, however, reveal Bennu has an especially rocky terrain. Since then, the asteroid's boulder-filled topography has created a challenge for the team to identify safe areas containing sampleable material, which must be fine enough, less than 1 inch or 2.5 centimeters in diameter, for the spacecraft's sampling mechanism to ingest it. So I guess if they plan for every scenario and replan and do backups, they've still run across something. They haven't been able to find a safe site that contains fine enough material. It seems that it's proving more difficult than they thought it would. So says Dante Loretta, OSIRIS-REx principal investigator at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and quote, "We knew that Bennu would surprise us, so we came prepared for whatever we might find. As with any mission of exploration, dealing with the unknown requires flexibility, resources, and ingenuity. The OSIRIS-REx team has demonstrated these essential traits for overcoming the unexpected throughout the Bennu encounter," end quote. But they still haven't told us why they're having problems choosing a site. I guess they said that they have to find one with fine enough material. Let's see. Okay, the original mission, scheduled intentionally, included more than 300 days of extra time during asteroid operations to address such unexpected challenges. In a demonstration of its flexibility and ingenuity in response to Bennu's surprises, the mission team is adapting its site selection process. Instead of down-selecting to the two final sites this summer, the mission will spend an additional 4 months studying the four candidate sites in detail, with a particular focus on identifying regions of fine grain, sampleable material from upcoming high-resolution observations of each site. The boulder maps that citizen science counters helped create. Okay, I'm going to go there again. The boulder maps that citizen science counters helped create through observations earlier this year were used as one of many pieces of data considered when assessing each site safety. The data collected will be key to selecting the final two sites best suited for sample collection. Now, this rang a bell because just last night I was reading something, I believe was on the internet, about an Israeli mission to, I could have been the moon, and how it crashed or crash landed. And one of the people on the mission said, "This is not easy stuff. It's difficult to put a spacecraft into orbit and then have it fly somewhere and then to control it from here. So it's very difficult." So again, I always applaud NASA for going to places like these asteroids, going to the outer planets, going to Pluto, studying the planets, their missions on these planets. There's extended. They learn so much. And just like the Israeli thing that crashed, the scientists said, this stuff is not easy. It's difficult. So kudos to NASA. We got to applaud them for doing this amazing stuff. And as we see, the Dante Loretta, the principal investigator, just told us there's so much that there's so many unknowns when they go up there. They have to plan for different scenarios and replan and do backups and everything. So it's not an easy thing. I guess now we take things for granted, like maybe heart transplants. We take for granted that a spacecraft lifts off from the Earth and puts people in the International Space Station or on Earth, where they stay for many months or a year. They do all kinds of research that we don't know about. And there's also talk of space tourism coming. This stuff to us now is, oh, big deal, no big deal. And this is what happened in the Apollo missions. The first Apollo 11 that landed on the moon, or I guess it was Apollo 11, wow, or the whole world was excited. After that, people got quickly bored until Apollo 13. Remember when Tom Cruise says on the movie, Houston, we have a problem. So that's when it captured the imagination of the world again. So these things are not easy. And just to save that Apollo 13, if you watch the movie, if you can believe the movie, this stuff is very difficult. Okay. In order to further adapt to Bennu's ruggedness, the OSIRIS-REx team has made other adjustments to its sample site identification process. So, you know what we can do now? Why don't we go for a break? I'll keep you in suspense, and maybe you are getting a bit tired. You want to go have a coffee. All you two listeners, or maybe three, that are listening to me, you can go get a coffee or a drink. And when we come back, we'll talk more about Bennu. So again, Bennu is the asteroid, and the OSIRIS-REx mission is now circling Bennu. In a few months, maybe 5 months, they'll go to the surface and collect regolith, the surface material. Okay, so I'm going to go for a break. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
In front of Gucci in the winter, I seen you with your girl, sporting, in your chinchilla fur. I was laid up in the cool black shader, looking at your face just pure with no makeup. A little bit of MAC lip gloss, hair in a bun, well done. Looking for a ring, I seen none, so I hopped out the coupe and hot the super stopping. Introduced like I'm shining, you my destiny. In your diamond cluster, too much just to touch you. Perfume down to your structure. Think I wait till the second.
This is Robin, the program manager at CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco, best astronomy program on the planet.
Put it in your purse and call.
On the telephone, she heard my voice. Tell me to pick her up in my Rolls Royce. If my Rolls Royce is not the ladies, then girl, I'm gonna take you in my Mercedes. If my Mercedes would have full up of the disease, then girl, I'm gonna take you in my Firebird. If my Firebird cannot pay the curve, girl, put your ass and the dumb at your butt.
We're getting closer. My player days is over. Well, maybe not completely, but still in all. Come here, let's see a hug on my bed. And let me get between your legs. Lay on your back, take it from the back. Like a bag you're supposed to. I know you like that. Scream with the neighbors when they sleep. Grab the sheets with your teeth. Wiggle your butt cheeks. Pour the styles over your body. Lick you up, treat you like a convenience store. Stick you up, take you to the balcony. Pick you up so you can look at the city while I'm digging your kitty. Then we drive into the sun.
Bard on the Beach Shakespeare Festival's 30th season is running now until September 21st. It's housed in two modern theater tents and situated on the spectacular waterfront setting of Vancouver's Vanier Park. On the BMO main stage is Taming of the Shrew, a hilarious runaway hit inspired by Bard's 2007 Wild West production. This plays in repertory with the Elizabethan-era romantic comedy Shakespeare in Love. On the Howard Family stage, there are two new innovative productions, Shakespeare's All's Well That Ends Well, set in India in the 1940s, and Coriolanus, a no-holds-barred political tragedy filled with resonance for our time. For tickets and information, visit bardonthebeach.org.
Let's see here, God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful. Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9 with Marco and Stefan Don.
I'm getting to the cemetery, money for my mind, is it pink like hop? Anyone me a foot off it, beg me no stop. Ring for my finger, ball me and Pamela. When done, touch road, every girl face drop. Number one in a good look book. Them mad cashier, no matter no look good. Authentic, nothing for my body ever book. 5-4, tell a girl me no show. Me no friendly girl, way off flop. If a girl big friend, then me have to pray that. If them want war, no shot a lick head top. Me no play like some USA girl. Just a lick when me slap it. Yeah, I feel right about if you think send me drop it. Money conversation on me at the topic. She free to me about text, but watch a man before me take that. Me no come for play that girl, I'm most mad. Me too bad. Ask about me sense. Play a game if they ever play. Play with me name is a shame. But them mother I go cry in a vein in a
rain. So let's talk more about Bennu. And I'm just going to kind of speed this up and finish this. I don't want to talk too much about one thing. So there's a video here. If you want to go see this, it's interesting. It would probably be interesting to see the video. It says NASA mission selects final four site candidates for asteroid sample return mission, dated August 12, 2019 on NASA.gov. And what they're doing is there's a spacecraft up there now circling since December. It's studying Bennu, mapping it, and choosing the final site where they're going to touch down. Or they're going to come down, not touch down. They're going to come close to the asteroids. The sample arm will extend out, touch the surface, blow nitrogen gas, which will hopefully knock some of the regolith, blow it up in the air, and it'll float back down into the capsule or into the container. Then they'll go up, sample it. If it's fine, they're going to return. If it's not, they'll do it again. Okay, so the four sites are diverse in both geographical location and geological features. While the amount of sampleable material in each site has yet to be determined, all four sites have been evaluated thoroughly to ensure the spacecraft's safety as it descends to, touches, and collects a sample from the asteroid surface. Nightingale is a northernmost site. There are multiple possible sampling regions in the site, which is set in a small crater, encompassed by a larger crater. The site contains mostly fine-grained, dark material and has a lotus albedo, a reflection, and the lowest surface temperature of the four sites. Kingfisher is in a small crater near Bennu's equator at 11 degrees north latitude. The crater has a diameter of 26 feet and is surrounded by boulders, although the site itself is free of large rocks. Among the four sites, Kingfisher has the strongest spectral signature for hydrated material, so that's probably something to do with life. Osprey is set in a small crater, 66 feet in diameter, which is also located in Benue's equatorial region, 11 degrees north latitude. There are several possible sampling regions within the site. The diversity of rock types in the surrounding area suggests that the regolith within Osprey may also be diverse. Osprey has the strongest spectral signature of carbon-rich material among the four sites, and Sunpiper is located in Bennu's southern hemisphere at 47 degrees south latitude. The site is in a relatively flat area on the wall of a large crater, 207 feet in diameter. Hydrated minerals are also present, which indicates that Sandpiper may contain unmodified water-rich material. So all these sites are in a crater, and they're all, I guess, NASA's mission is to find life outside. So I guess they want to connect certain things where life could have started, what life originated as, what was necessary for life, what kind of materials or minerals or elements or compounds are necessary for life. This fall, OSIRIS-REx will begin detailed analysis of the four candidate site during the reconnaissance phase. During the first stage of this phase, the spacecraft will execute high passes over each of the four sites from a distance of 0.08 miles or 1.29 kilometers to confirm they are safe and contain sampleable material. This is all great stuff. I mean, I guess they had to know this before going up there. It would be quite interesting to see how they planned all this. Close-up imaging also will map the features and landmarks required for the spacecraft autonomous navigation to the asteroid surface. The team will use the data from these passes to select the final primary and backup sample collection sites in December. Whew. The second and third stages of reconnaissance will begin in early 2020, when the spacecraft will perform passes over the final two sites at lower altitudes and take even higher resolution observations of the surface to identify features, such as groupings of rocks that will be used to navigate to the surface for sample collection. So what this said just now in that sentence, it contradicts what I said earlier. I thought they were going to sample in December, but I think they will probably do it in early 2020, it seems. I don't know if things have been delayed or not. OSIRIS-REx sample collection is scheduled for the latter half of 2020. Wow, I thought it was going to happen in the latter part of 2019, but it looks like the latter half of 2020. So maybe in like August, September, October. So it's going to take longer than I thought it was. I thought the spacecraft would be there for a year, but it looks like it's going to be there for at least a year and a half. And the spacecraft will return the asteroid samples to Earth on September 24, 2023. So it looks like it takes about 3 years to fly back and forth. I don't know if flying back to Earth is easier, because what you're doing when you're flying out against the sun's gravity. When you're flying in, you're flying, the gravity of the sun is pulling you in. So maybe that's why it could take longer to fly out. Just like when, for example, when I used to work in Tokyo, I'd fly out to Tokyo, and one of the ways would take 1 hour more, because in the other way, which took 1 hour less, there was winds pushing you. So I think from Tokyo to Vancouver takes 8.5 hours, and it's possible from Vancouver to Tokyo takes 9.5 hours because of the winds. So we can maybe set an analogy that the sun works in the same way. When you fly out, you get a gravity assist from some planet, maybe the Earth. We don't know which. It could have been the Earth. It could have also been Pluto. And then when you're flying back, you're being pulled by the sun. That could be. This is all my speculation. Okay, so this is NASA's Bennu mission, or OSIRIS-REx mission. So you can go to www.nasa.gov/OSIRIS-REx. So that's OSIRIS-REx. Or you can go to www.asteroidmission.org. I've been doing that mission or that page because I have been studying for my exam to be a NASA ambassador. So hopefully I will pass that. So you can go to www.asteroidmission.org for just general information, or www.asteroidmission.org/candidate-sample-sites. And it's quite an interesting thing. And of course, this is maybe I'm dreaming or speculating, but 50 years from now, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, maybe our race will be living on other parts of the solar system, on Mars or the moon, or going out to other parts, and in a couple hundred years or 500 years, and the asteroids will be, the comets will be sites where the spaceships could get close or dock to get materials. And I don't know if they can get water, but they can get maybe hydrogen or maybe some kind of oxygen. And that's why some of maybe these studies are going on, because they are exploration in its purest form. They're exploring something. And maybe they have plans for the future, but a lot of what they learn will be put into use in future missions. So, again, this is NASA mission selects final four site candidates for asteroid sample return mission dated August 12, 2019. It shows the four sites, and it also has a nice little video here, so you can go to that page, and maybe it can occupy your time for a while. Okay, so let's go to this other one. 30th year, you know how I love anniversaries. This is called 30 Years Ago, Voyager 2's Historic Neptune Flyby. So I did Voyager a couple of years ago. So to refresh everyone's memory, the two Voyager spacecrafts took off in latter 1977 to do flybys to the gas giants, because they were in a particular alignment that happens, I believe, only once in 176 years when they're close to each other in their orbits. So you can use gravity assist and spend a lot less time going to those places if you jump from planet to planet. So that's what the Voyagers did. They had an initial plan of seeing Jupiter and Saturn, and then it was extended to go to Neptune and Uranus. Voyager 2, that's what we're talking about today. Voyager 1 went straight out to the interstellar space where it is now. I think both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are in interstellar space. But as I read a couple of weeks ago, I think a study of the moon Titan in Saturn's system was a key objective for the mission. And the way that the spacecraft would have left Voyager after visiting Titan, the second biggest moon in the solar system, the biggest moon in Saturn's system, the way it left, it was not possible for it to fly by Neptune and Uranus later. So what happened if Voyager 1 failed in its mission, if it didn't get proper data? I believe NASA scientists would have had to choose with going to study Titan again. And by doing so, the orientation of the spacecraft or the orbit, it could not get the gravity assist that would have sent it on into Uranus and Neptune. So Voyager 1 thankfully did its mission. It retrieved a lot of information about Titan, the information that scientists want to. And Titan has a hydrocarbon-rich atmosphere, and it's got hydrocarbon lakes and rivers. And I believe scientists speculate Earth could have been something like Titan billions of years ago. So a lot of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are interesting in themselves in terms of finding something that that the conditions then would mimic what happened on Earth, and also maybe more important for Ganymede, I'm not sure if it's Ganymede or Europa in Jupiter's system, but Enceladus in Saturn's system, some of these moons, big moons, really big moons, bigger than Mercury, some of them, or one of them is, are close to the size of Mercury. They have subsurface oceans, and they believe salty oceans. So could life exist there? So with this Voyager 2 mission, Voyager 1 had to do its duty, and it did it. It gleaned all the information it needed from its flyby of the moon Titan. And so it shot out into interstellar space. And because it did a good job, Voyager 2 could be slingshotted out after and could visit Uranus and Neptune. And if Voyager 1 didn't do its mission, I believe they would have had to choose, well, are we going to go to Uranus and Neptune, or are we going to have to study Titan because Voyager 1 didn't do what we thought it would do? But Voyager 1 did, so now we're talking about Voyager 2 historic Neptune flyby 30 years ago. So this is on NASA.gov. It says the title of the article is 30 Years Ago, Voyager 2's Historic Neptune Flyby, dated August 21st, 2019. So that is yesterday. Oh, so that's a very fresh article. Okay, so there's a nice picture of Neptune. And I think the scientists were so excited when they got to Neptune, the Voyager 2, because Uranus was quite bland, kind of a gray, milky, grayish, milky surface with gas surface with nothing interesting. I guess they learned a lot of interesting things. I believe Uranus is tilted 90 degrees, so it spins on its side, and it could be retrograde motion, which means it goes in the opposite direction, or one of its moons does. But anyway, Uranus wasn't as exciting as they thought they'd be. So when the cameras came to Neptune, the scientists were so excited because here's a beautiful blue planet with storms and all these rings, and they found rings in Jupiter and all this stuff. Okay, so this picture of Neptune was taken by Voyager 2 less than 5 days before the probe's closest approach of the planet on August 25th, 1989. So that is 23. This Sunday will be the 30th anniversary. The picture shows the great dark spot, a storm in Neptune's atmosphere, and the bright light blue smudges of clouds that accompanies the storm. So there's a storm, and I believe the storm, it was clocked at almost 1,400 miles per hour. So our storms on Earth are really nothing to what some of the other storms in the solar systems, other regions and planets are like. So we're quite lucky, and we have our magnetosphere to protect us against solar storms. So I'm going to start reading on. So again, the article is called 30 Years Ago, Voyager 2's Historic Neptune Flyby, dated August 21st, 2019. So 30 years ago, on NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft made a close flyby of Neptune, giving humanity its first close-up of our solar system's eighth planet. So again, some of these places like Pluto, when the spacecraft New Horizons went by it, and also Uranus and Neptune, even Hubble could not image them very well, especially Pluto. All we'd see is a blob of light. That's it. So going there was really something that was so spectacular, and you could actually see these beautiful planets. Whew. Marking the end of the Voyager mission's grand tour of the solar system's four giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, the first was also a last. No other spacecraft has visited Neptune since. So there's lots of things that scientists learned also before going there. Before, I guess they sent two spacecraft called Pathfinders to see how it would be going through the asteroid belt. And apparently, there's not much material in the asteroid belt. There's not enough material to even worry about. So there's lots of firsts that happen. So says Ed Stone, a professor of physics at Caltech and Voyager's project scientist since 1975, and someone I admire probably as much as any other scientist, maybe Kip Thorne and Ed Stone, those two people, wow. And of course, our Dr. Matthew here at UBC. Okay, Dr. Matthews. So says Ed Stone, and quote, "The Voyager planetary program really was an opportunity to show the public what science is all about. Every day we learn something new," end quote. Wrapped in a teal and cobalt color bands of cloud, the planet that Voyager 2 revealed looked like a blue-hued sibling to Jupiter and Saturn, the blue indicating the presence of methane. So I believe the two other planets, Uranus and Neptune, they don't call them gas planets, gas giants. They call them ice giants because they have this icy methane and ice, maybe ice water. Okay, I'll read on. "A massive slate-colored storm was dubbed the Great Dark Spot, similar to Jupiter's Great Red Spot. Six new moons and four rings were discovered." So again, they discovered moons and all these other, rings in these other planets and Jupiter, so all this cool stuff. "During the encounter, the engineering team carefully changed the probe's direction and speed so that it could do a close flyby of the planet's largest moon, Triton. The flyby showed evidence of geologically young surfaces and active geysers spewing material skyward. This indicated that Triton was not simply a solid ball of ice, even though it had the lowest surface temperature of any natural body observed by Voyager, minus 391 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 235 degrees Celsius. So that's, yes, I think that's a little cold. The conclusion of the Neptune flyby marked the beginning of the Voyager interstellar mission, which continues today, 42 years after launch. Voyager 2 and its twin, Voyager 1, which has also flown by Jupiter and Saturn, continue to send back dispatches from the outer reaches of our solar system. At the time of the Neptune encounter, Voyager 2 was about 2.9 billion miles, 4.7 billion kilometers from Earth. Today it is 11 billion miles, 18 billion kilometers from us. The faster moving Voyager 1 is 13 billion miles or 21 billion kilometers from Earth. So I believe their signals, the strength of the signal is 1/1,000,000th of a watt. So it's very, very weak, but somehow these scientists are able to get that signal. And if you open your refrigerator, I believe, has something like a 30-watt light bulb. So these Voyagers send back signals that are so much weaker, and they had to develop technology while the mission was going out there to be able to acquire these signals. So there's a nice picture here. Again, this article is called 30 Years Ago, Voyager 2's Historic Neptune Flyby, dated August 21, 2019. And here's the moon. This global color mosaic shows Neptune's largest moon, Triton. Pink-hued methane ice may compose a massive polar cap on the moon's surface. Methane ice, cool. While dark streaks overlaying this ice is thought to be dust deposited from use, geyser-like plumes that are dropped from Titan surfaces. So this is quite an interesting thing. It's not just the planets. The moons of these outer planets are proving probably just as interesting as the planets themselves. So if we begin at Jupiter, we have Io. Looks like a pizza. Its surface looks like a pepperoni pizza with pepperoni and cheddar and mozzarella cheese. It's all kind of colored like that. And there's all kinds of volcanoes, like lava spouting out. And from the gravity of Jupiter and the other moons, it pulls and tugs on Io's surface, which creates friction and heat, and then we got geysers. And then some of the two of the moons, I believe it, two, it could be more, they have subsurface oceans. That's Jupiter's moon, and some of these subsurface oceans may contain more water than covers the Earth. And then if we go to Titan, there is Saturn's moon. It's got hydrocarbon lakes, hydrocarbon rivers, and the atmosphere is thick enough where if you had wings, you can float through the atmosphere. That's how thick it is. And then there's Enceladus, which sprouts geysers on one of its poles. I believe it's southern pole, but I might get it wrong, so don't nail me to that. I'm not sure about that. Okay. And so all these moons are interesting as themselves, and I believe one thing that I found very interesting is some of the moons may form in Saturn's rings. They accumulate, and then they move out from the rings. So I think Jupiter has about 71 moons, known moons, and Saturn has about 62. And the moons themselves, some of them look ghastly. Some of them look very interesting. So these moons can be just as interesting study targets as the planets themselves. And of course, one of the people that I'm really indebted to is Miss Trina Ray, a genius scientist from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, because she has come on my show twice, and she is so knowledgeable, and she's so kind to me, and her scientific level is, I'm not even close to her. And she treats me so well, so she's very nice. So she worked on the, what's it called? She worked on the Saturn mission. What's it called again? Oh, I should know this. But now she's going to work on the Clipper mission, and I'm going to I'm going to try to look it up. So what is the Clipper mission? Okay, so the Clipper mission is to Europa. And that's one of the moons of Jupiter. And NASA's Europa Clipper will conduct detailed reconnaissance of Jupiter's moon, Europa, and investigate whether the icy moon could harbor conditions suitable for life. So I believe Trina Rae is going to be on that mission. I don't know if she's on there yet because she's close. That's at Cassini. So they finished the Cassini mission a year or two ago, and they're closing that up. And they're going to go to Europa, and it says the launch date is going to be the 2020s. So the mission will place a spacecraft in orbit around Jupiter in order to perform a detailed investigation of Europa, a world that shows strong evidence for an ocean of liquid water beneath its icy crust and which could host conditions favorable for life. The mission will send a highly capable radiation-tolerant spacecraft into a long, looping orbit around Jupiter to perform repeated close flybys of the icy moon. So I'm not sure if they are going to touch the moon or like this OSIRIS-REx mission. So NASA has selected 9 instruments for this mission. The selected payload includes cameras and spectrometers to produce high-resolution images of Europa's surface and determine its composition. An ice-penetrating radar will determine the thickness of the moon's icy shell and search for subsurface lakes similar to those beneath Antarctica's ice sheet. The mission will also carry a magnetometer to measure the strength and direction of the moon's magnetic field, which will allow scientists to determine the depth and salinity of its ocean. Gravity measurements will also confirm the existence of Europa's subsurface ocean. So, in 2012, NASA's Hubble Space Telescope observed water vapor above the south polar region of Europa, providing potential evidence of water plumes. If the plumes' existence is confirmed and they're linked to a subsurface ocean, studying their composition will help scientists investigate the chemical makeup of Europa's potentially habitable environment while minimizing the need to drill through layers of ice. During the nominal mission, the spacecraft will perform 45 flybys of Europa at closest approach altitudes varying from 1,700 miles to 16 miles or 2,700 kilometers to 25 kilometers above the surface. So imagine, now I'm thinking about, I'm incredibly grateful that I'm able to live one of my dreams and do this talk show, even though I have but one or two listeners like Tim Shannon. So imagine what Trina Rae did. Trina Rae did, she worked on the, first she got some postgraduate degrees, and that's interesting in itself. Then she worked on the Voyager mission, which is my baby. I love the Voyager. It's my number one favorite one mission. Then she worked on Cassini for 20, 25 years or something like that. And now she's going to work on Europa Clipper. Now, is that interesting or what? Is that something to ooh and ah about? So way to grow, Trina Rae. So this is the Clipper mission that they're going to conduct detailed reconnaissance of Jupiter's moon Europa. Europa Clipper will determine if this ocean world has environments that are suitable for life. So the mission is confirmed. It will go in 2020. It will be part of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So maybe Trina doesn't even have to move out of her office, or maybe she does. Who knows? But here there's a beautiful, if you go to europa.nasa.gov, it shows... here is another, it just automatically clicked to another one. I'm going to go back because this is so cool. Radiation map of Europa, key to future missions. So it shows certain hydrocarbons. Very cool. And of course, on the first page, it shows the Europa Clipper high gain antenna undergoes testing. So this is europa.nasa.gov. So that is, and it shows the project scientists. And I'm wondering if I could find, it's a big picture, I won't look for Trina Rae, I'll look at another time. But it says here, old data reveal new evidence of Europa plumes. Scientists re-examining the data from an old mission found independent evidence that the moon's subsurface liquid water reservoir may be venting plumes of water vapor above its icy shell. So you know what? I was on Neptune, and then I kind of went over to Europa. So I'm going to go back to the Neptune, okay? So I'm going to go back to the Neptune thing. And when we were looking at, because it's 30 years since Voyager, we have to salute that. So here we are. The conclusion of the Neptune flyby marked the beginning of the Voyager interstellar mission. Okay. By the time Voyager 2 reached Neptune, the Voyager mission had completed 5 planetary encounters. But the Big Blue Planet still posed unique challenges. About 30 times, so it's 30 astronomical units, that's what I was going to say earlier. About 30 times farther from the Sun than Earth is. So the distance between the Sun and Earth is 1 astronomical unit. The distance between the Sun and Neptune is 30 astronomical units. So it's very far. So by taking advantage of this planetary alignment in the late 70s and the early 80s, the distances to fly between the planets would be considerably shorter, and gravity assists from certain planets. So, for example, when Voyager 2 left Uranus, it would get a gravity assist. It would fly close to Uranus, yep, and it would borrow some Uranus's gravitational potential energy and be shot out very fast and on its way to Neptune. But the Big Blue Planet still poses unique challenges. About 30 times farther than the Sun than Earth is, the icy giant receives only 0.001 times the amount of sunlight that Earth does. In such low light, Voyager 2's camera required longer exposures to get quality images. Now, I would have never thought of that, but these scientists think of these things before they go. But because the spacecraft would reach a maximum speed of about 60,000 miles per hour, or 90,000 kilometers per hour relative to Earth, a long exposure time would make the image blurry. Imagine trying to take a picture of a roadside sign from the window of a speeding car. So the team programmed Voyager 2's thrusters to fire gently during the close approach, rotating the spacecraft to keep the camera focused on its target without interrupting the spacecraft's overall speed and direction. Now, isn't that cool? Aren't they clever? The probe's great distance also meant that by the time radio signals from Voyager 2 reached Earth, they were weaker than those of other flybys. But the spacecraft had advantage of time. The Voyagers communicated with Earth via the Deep Space Network, or DSN, which utilizes radio antennas at sites in Madrid, Spain, Canberra, Australia, and Goldstone, California. So I believe what happened, I won't read on, but they had to configure and make up these sites during the time the Voyagers were flying. Let's see if that's true. During Voyager 2 Uranus counter in 1986, the 3 largest DSN antennas were 64 meters wide. To assist with the Neptune counter, the DSN expanded the dishes to 70 meters. They also included nearby non-DSS antennas to DSN antenna, Deep Space Network, DSN antennas to collect data, including another 64-meter dish in Parks, Australia, and multiple 25-meter antennas at the Very Large Array in New Mexico. So I'm going to conclude because I have to get off. I can't sit here for hours, can I? So thank you for listening. I thought, well, you know, if you ask me, astronomy is always cool. So here's one, an article. NASA seeks big ideas from universities for tech to study dark regions of the moon. So that is another thing. NASA does all this cool stuff. Is it cool? Okay. So now I think here's another one. Sorry, it's an anniversary, so I got to speak it. I got to say it. Peanuts toys and books commemorate 50th anniversary of Apollo. So I believed one of the spacecraft were called Snoopy, and one of the spacecrafts were called Charlie Brown. So we can do that next time. So thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You have been listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. And next up is just some cool and groovy tunes. Thank you for listening. Bye.